I'm not sure how many of you have been watching the little following article, anyway, the results of this following article that I noticed on the internet. And apparently there's American Idol run by Fox News, I think it is. And I happened to hear about this. I have no idea when this actually took place. Apparently it took place fairly recently. I'm sure somebody can put me right in the chat room afterwards. But it says, Kerry did it. It says it's a long way from Oklahoma to Hollywood, both in distance and mindset, but for Kerry Underwood, it was a trip worth taking. Kerry stood head and shoulders above more than 100,000 contestants as the best undiscovered voice of America. And with a few singles about to rocket up in the charts and a debut album on the way, Kerry will immediately join Kelly Rubin and Fantasia, whoever they are, as American Idol made chart toppers. But she couldn't have done it without you, the people who tune in each week to watch every performance, the people who phone in their support for hours and hours, the people who come to the show, buy the CDs, give the show life. Thanks to everybody for another amazing session of American Idol. And congratulations to Kerry Underwood, America's newest superstar. Now, I have never seen Kerry Underwood. I've never seen American Idol. I've heard a little bit about it. But I thought that that was quite interesting to do with the topic that I want to deal with today. Because what I wanted to actually talk about today is I would like to talk about modern idols. Modern idols. And I want to show really how idolatry is still a problem within our society. It's a problem within our society for the end time. It's the society that actually will spark Laodicea. It's where Laodicea comes out of. There's an attitude and frame of mind that gives rise to Laodicea that will in fact go through that tribulation, which we're looking at as far as the sermonette was concerned, as far as the emergence of a Europe. And it won't be fascist in the way that Hitler necessarily was fascist. It will be the way it was going right back into the Middle Ages. It is a revival of the European, it's the Holy Roman Empire. That's what we're looking at, and that's what we'll actually witness. However, it will actually come out. But the society that spawns Laodicea, the churches is going to go into that, is a certain type of society, and it is a society that has idolatry as a problem. And every single one of us live in that society, and we draw certain concepts from that society. We also, if we're not careful, have idolatry as a problem. So what we need to do is we need to go back, if we're going to understand this subject, we need to go back and understand the subject of idolatry itself. And I've got 7 points I want to go through. The first one I want to deal with is the Sabbath and idolatry are the two areas which were highlighted, in fact, as far as Israel is concerned, in the captivity of Israel before. Secondly, I want to talk about our attitude to idols here in the church, here in Europe, in Britain, in America, within the Western world. Thirdly, I want to talk about food offered to idols in the New Testament, because that was a specific problem that they were dealing with, and we also have to deal with this. You may think it's not, but it is. It's something we also deal with. I want to talk fourthly about idolatrous containers. Now, you'll see what I mean when we go on and read some of the scriptures involved in that particular section. And fifthly, I want to point out a scripture which talks about covetousness, which is idolatry. So covetousness is a spiritual form of idolatry, so that's something that we need to again be fully aware of. Sixthly, I want to deal with one of those areas, one of those spiritual areas, and the one idol that every single one of us probably has is ourself. That is an area, the area that we need to really look at. And finally, I want to talk about how the Sabbath points us all back on track. Because remember, it's the Sabbath and idolatry that God really goes for in many respects, as far as the captivity. It was highlighted as these are really the problems. And they are linked together. They certainly are linked together. So let's have a look at the first aspect I want to deal with. That is the way in which it is mentioned and linked together as far as Sabbath and idolatry is concerned. Let's turn over to Ezekiel chapter 20. Ezekiel chapter 20. In Ezekiel 20, we'll see here that it's talking, yes, about Israel of old, and it's talking about Judah of old as well, but it's talking about how the Sabbath and idolatry was a problem for them. But it then goes into the future, and we'll just notice in verse 15 of Ezekiel 20, it says, "Yes, also I lifted up my hand unto them in the wilderness, that I would not bring them into the land which had given them, flowing with milk and honey." Now here is talking about Israel, and if you go in the, if you read the entire chapter, you'll find that it's really talking about Israel when they first were taken out of Egypt, and they were given his laws, and the way in which it progressed, and the way in which they turned away, and they rebelled against God, and they turned away, and they did every man, it's, notice verse 8, "But they rebelled against me, and would not listen to me. They did not every man cast away the abominations of their eyes, neither did they forsake the idols of Egypt. And then I say, I'll pour out my fury on them." So it's a step-by-step situation as we go and read through this particular section. And here in verse 15 it says, "I lifted up my hand upon them in the wilderness, that I would not bring them into the land which I had given them, flowing with milk and honey, which is the glory of all lands. Because they despised my judgments, and walked not in my statutes, but polluted my Sabbaths, for their heart went after their idols." So they were given the Sabbaths, and yet the problem was the idolatry. So here were the Sabbaths that were given to them as an antidote, as something to keep them on the right track, but instead they went after their idols. And as we'll go on and find out, that this is very true, really, today as well. It goes on into today. Listen, in verse 23, it says, "I lifted up my hand also unto them also in the wilderness, that I would scatter them among the nations, and disperse them through the countries." So this was after they'd go into the land, this is what would happen if they rebelled. And it says, "Because they had not executed my judgments, but had despised my statutes, and had polluted my Sabbaths, plural, and their eyes were after their father's idols." So again, we see the two things being linked together within these verses, and it's looking at Israel in the past, and what in fact happened to Israel in the past. But when we go on a little bit further, notice in verse 33, it says, "As I live, says the Eternal, the Lord Eternal, surely with a mighty hand, with a stretched out arm, and with fury poured out, I will rule over you. And I will bring you from the people, out from the people, and I will gather you out of the countries where you are scattered, with a mighty hand, and with a stretched out arm, and with fury poured out, and I will bring you into the wilderness of the people, for there will I plead with you face to face." Now, this area isn't just talking about Israel of old. This area now is talking about Israel in the future, as it goes into the promised land, into the very world tomorrow, under the rulership of the divine kingdom. But here it says, "And like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt, so I will plead with you, said the Lord Eternal. And I will," and it goes in, "I'll cause you to pass under the rod," in other words, as if it's like a tithe. And down in verse 42, and it says, "And you shall know that I am the Eternal, when I will bring you into the land of Israel, into the country from which I lifted up my hand to give it to your fathers. And there shall you remember your ways, and all your doings, in which you have been defiled. And you will loathe yourself in your own sight, for all the evils that you have committed. And you shall know that I am the Eternal, when I have wrought with you for my name's sake, not according to your wicked ways, but according to your corrupt doings, O you house of Israel, said the Lord Eternal." So again, we're looking into the future, when God will bring them into the wilderness, and will pass them under the rod, bring them into the very promised land. And it's all, it flows from one point, from the point in the past, right into today, how the rebels will be purged from Israel. And we can see the same thing taking place over in Isaiah. If you turn back to Isaiah 2, we find the same thing being mentioned here. Again, how it flows from one to another, but this one is even more so towards the end. Now, what I would like to do really is not concentrate on the Sabbath aspect today. I want to concentrate on the idolatry side. And then next Sabbath, my plan is to play a tape from Mr. Armstrong, which will deal with the Sabbath. So the two, in fact, are going to form one message as such. But the Sabbath question will play again next week. That's on the Sabbath, just before Pentecost. But here in Isaiah chapter 2, we see in the beginning of Isaiah 2, it says, the word that Isaiah the son of Amos saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, and it come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the eternal house shall be established in the top of the mountains and be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. So we're looking into the last days. It's looking into the end time. It's not just looking into the time at that particular point. And it says many people will come and say, let us go up to the mountain of the eternal, to the house of the God of Jacob. You're not going to find that today. You haven't found that in the past. It says, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in the paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, the Torah, the way, the pointing, and the word of the eternal from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among all the nations, and he will rebuke many people. And they will beat their swords to plowshares, and their spears to pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. That is the future. Clear. Absolute. No question about it. But notice what it says. The problems. It says, O house of Jacob, come and let us walk in the light of the eternal. Therefore you have forsaken your people, the house of Jacob, because they have replenished from the east. Now, I always remember, it was Mr. McNair who conducted that first baptizing tour into India. And one thing, I remember him coming back from India, it was the late 60s, and coming back from India giving a series of Bible studies on the subject of what he discovered. The thing that sticks out in my mind is the fact that he was approached by a demon-possessed man who said to him, we are going to the West. And from that point, from that time, it was the late 60s, within about a few months, the Beatles had suddenly switched across the Maharishi Yoga, and we had the Eastern influence all throughout the Western world. That happened. And it was uncanny how that was highlighted, and that was given to the church at that time as the first baptismal tour into India, and this was given to the knowledge came through. And it says here, therefore you have forsaken your people. Remember where this is coming. This is coming in chapter 2, immediately after a section about the future. It is not talking about a time way back then. Forsaken your people, the house of Jacob, because they've been replenished from the east, and are soothsayers like the Philistines, and they please themselves in the children of strangers. There is a multiculturalism in today's society, which is destroying today's society, which is bringing the Western nations down. And it says, their land is also full of silver and gold, neither is there any end of their treasures. They flows in from the east today, from China as the manufacturer. It's not just the religious side, but even the goods are flowing in. Their land also is full of horses, neither is there any end of their chariots. You know, it talks about many shall rush to and fro. Well, it's many shall dawdle to and fro on the M25, believe you me. You know, we just about, I don't know how many hours we spent on that particular motorway over the last week. But why are we dawdling on the M25 every rush hour? Because there's never end of their chariots. And what are these chariots? Their land is also full of idols. Game Boys, PlayStations, wide TV screens, internet, broadband. We've just got broadband. They worship the works of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made. And remember where this is. Remember the context. It's not talking about people way back when. It's talking about the time just before Christ returns. The time we're in now. It's talking to us. It's specifically talking to the church. That which their own fingers have made. And the mean man bows down. The great man humbles himself. In other words, from the top to the bottom, they're all interested in their idols and these things that they've made. Even this pop idol, or this whatever it was called, American Idol, or whatever they call these things. And the superstars and the sports personalities, and on it goes. All of these things, it says, from the great man to the mean man, they all bow down, they all humble themselves. Therefore, do not forgive them. And down in verse 17, it says, the loftiness of man will be bowed down, the haughtiness of man will be made low, and the eternal alone will be exalted in that day. There is a day coming when this will be the case, when the rightful, not idol, he's not an idol, but the rightful God will have his position in the minds of men. And the idols he shall utterly abolish, remove them completely. And they will go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth for the fear of the Eternal, the glory of his majesty, when he arises to shake terribly the earth. This is all future. This is not back, way back when. This is now, as we are approaching this time. In that day, a man will cast his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which they made each one for himself, to worship to the moles and to the bats. And the whole thing will be just completely destroyed. And remember what I said right at the very beginning. Out of this society, Laodicea arises. Out of this society comes someone saying they are rich, they're increased with goods, they've got need of nothing, and they don't realize how poor, blind, and miserable, naked they are, and how vulnerable the very society is. You know, we go down to the supermarket here, and on the way back, we stopped at the supermarket, we saw all these people, it was one of these huge hypermarkets. You stop the transportation, we've got famine on the streets. The thing that has given us all this vast wealth is our Achilles heel. It will destroy us. And it's certainly something that we need to be aware of, because, you know, it does seem to, that this will be the case. All the Game Boys, all the various bits of gold that are in the chips and on the very, and there are precious materials in this electronic wizardry. All the gold contacts and everything else, they're cast on the streets, and they will not, you know, what value is it? So as I say, Laodicea comes from this mold. We therefore need to listen very carefully to what God is talking about, Sabbath and idolatry, and how these words do apply. They apply to us specifically. So what should the attitude be as far as idols are concerned? Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 7. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, you know, God has a great deal to say to ancient Israel. And remember who this God is. Not some God way back when. This God is Jesus Christ. This was the God of the Old Testament. He was the one that became Jesus Christ. It's a living word. And Jesus Christ gave these words to Israel of old. He does not change. He's the same today as he was before. He does not change. And he is also the head of the church. The leadership that we had under Mr. Armstrong was coming from Jesus Christ. It's not Mr. Armstrong. It's Jesus Christ who is leading the church. And we must be led by the same spirit, by the same way, by the same individual today. Every single one of us within the church. So here in Deuteronomy, he is leading his people at that time, albeit a carnal people. But Deuteronomy chapter 7, it says verse 1, when the Eternal your God will bring you into the land in which you are going to possess it, and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. It's interesting that he got these seven nations, a complete number, and it was all designed. And when the Eternal your God shall deliver them before you, you shall smite them and utterly destroy them. You will make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. It's interesting, I got an email from somebody a few days ago now. And he happened to make a comment about the way in which Ephraim, in fact, misused their influence when they went into Africa. And yes, that is true. Ephraim did misuse their influence as they went into Africa. However, this is coming, I would imagine, from books, modern books that have been written about the empire and how evil the empire is. How basically the British Empire was an evil thing that went out and destroyed these poor people with their cultures. I've seen a certain amount of the culture that comes out of Juju, which was there in West Africa, in around Benin, in around in Nigeria today. And the fact that the British went in there and the empire was placed in that area was beneficial. It was not detrimental. Is it Suti, where they had the wives that were burnt in India? That was put a stop to. And there were many beneficial things because this, and again, what are you looking at? You're looking at things like totem poles in America. America basically is now bringing all this culture back in. The totem pole is a series of Indian gods. You're looking here. You shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercies to them. Neither shall you make marriages with them. Your daughter you will not give to unto his son, or his daughter you shall not take to your son. For they will turn away your son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So I will the anger of the Eternal be kindled against you and destroy you suddenly. And yet that's not what we've done. I've got an article here. It was in the paper last Monday. An heiress called Doris Duke. Apparently, she had about 2 billion in that she inherited from a large tobacco company magnate who was her father, and she did have a rather miserable life in many ways. But it's the actual title. It says Britain gets poor little rich girls' treasures, and it gives pictures on here. It says that a rare Thai book and a gilt Buddha shrine are amongst the gifts of Doris Duke Wright coming to Britain. And she had a collection, and it says here, it says the gift also gives Britain its first 18th and 19th century Thai manuscript chests, cabinets up to 6 feet tall, decorated in red lacquer, gold leaf, which were used by Buddhist monasteries to store sacred scriptures. Seven will be going to the British Library and one each to the V&A and the British Museums. So many of these objects are very beautiful and they fill major gaps in British collections, said Dr. Ginsberg. Now, according to God, albeit that they are beautiful, the thing that is being said here, that you basically destroy them, that you get rid of them. Why? Because it turns. But under multiculturalism, then you see this being progressively eroded. And today, in today's society, when we're looking at our attitude to idols, what is our attitude to such things? Let's have a look at another section here, just another quote. Because at the same time as this is coming in, these shrines and these various bits and pieces that are coming in from these other cultures, at the same time, there's another quote from June the 3rd, which is yesterday, I believe. Offensive hospital Bibles may be banned. And it says the century-old tradition of Bibles in hospital bedside lockers could be ended in one health trust today after officials decided that they may offend the ethnic minorities. So at the same time as we're getting the multiculturalism in, the very words of God, the thing that made the English, caused English greatness, according to Victoria, is being progressively eroded all the time. And can you see, therefore, that within this society that we find ourselves today, we find this erosion and we find this acceptance of idolatry, of literal physical idols. And I'm not talking about just the Game Boys. I'm talking about literal idols, and there is an acceptance within our society, and that acceptance does trickle down to the church. It trickles down to you and to me, and we have an acceptance of these things which are abhorrent in the eyes of God. So it says, but you shall deal with them, thus you shall deal with them. Verse 5, you shall destroy their altars, break down their images, cut down their groves, burn their graven images with fire, for you are a holy people unto the Eternal your God. The Eternal your God has chosen you to be a special people unto himself, above all people that are upon the face of the earth. Those were the instructions to ancient Israel, our forefathers, as they went into the land. And these kind of instructions coming from this book were put into effect to some degree, not to a huge degree, but to some degree, within America, certainly, as they came across things like totem poles, which are now being accepted. And when they came across in Africa, practices, and India and elsewhere, practices which were wrong. Now, it wasn't entirely so, but it is something that did actually occur. You see, what is it? What is God's way? What is the way of, what is the Torah? What is the way of God, the law, the Torah? It's God's lifestyle. What's another word for God's lifestyle? God's culture is another word for God's lifestyle. So multiculturalism doesn't fit. Multiculturalism is not what we'll be implementing. And if we have the ideas that come from this multicultural society which we find ourselves in, and we look upon the empire and where, in fact, biblical values were imposed in certain instances as being evil and wrong, which is coming out of our society today, will we be fit to be teachers in the world tomorrow? Will we be ready for that kingdom when it does occur, and when, in fact, Israel will have the rebels purged from it so that it can then start as a model nation and do the job properly at that time? But you see, what is our attitude towards idolatry, toward these kind of things? Turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Because we need to ask ourselves, what about lucky charms? What about lucky charms? What about crucifixes? We need to ask ourselves whether, in fact, this is a correct thing to be involved with. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, notice in verse 14 it says, do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. It is the same kind of thing that we find regarding multiculturalism when you're looking at what was given to ancient Israel. For what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness, and what communion has light with darkness? You can't start mixing the two. What concord has Christ with Belial, with Baal, with the Lord that we find in society today, which, you know, Lord this, Lord that, but it's not the true Lord, it's not the true Christ, the Messiah, with Belial? Or what part is he that believes with an infidel, an unbeliever, an atheist? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God, and as God has said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord, and touch not the unclean, and I will receive you, and will be a father to you, and you will be my sons and my daughters, said the Lord Almighty. Having therefore these promises, dearly beloved, remember there's no chapter break, let us clean ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. And that's what this subject is about. It's about the church getting back on track, perfecting holiness, getting our attitude sorted out, our approach towards idolatry, our approach towards the things that the world holds in such great esteem, things which are beautiful. I mean, this Buddhist shrine, certainly is incredible work done into it. These various texts, the ivory that's there, incredible work done into it. But you compare that with the Bibles being removed from the hospitals, you see a trend within society. And that is affecting the church. That is something there. I remember going into, coming in contact with a member one time, and they basically like to use Egyptian hieroglyphics for decoration. I'm sorry, but Egyptian hieroglyphics for decoration, is it wise? I mean, it's hieroglyphics. What's in there? What are the gods that are actually in there, in those hieroglyphics? Do some research. You do not want to go ahead and decorate your home with pagan gods. It is the antithesis of God's way. The New Age icons, the crystals that you find within the New Age movement, that's all around us. Over here in Wales, we're lousy with it. We really are. We've got to be circumspect in such things. We've got to understand what God's mind is on this particular situation. I remember one time, and it wasn't that long ago, a few years ago, that there was an object that we had in the home, which was a bell. And it was something that was in Judy's family for as long as she can remember. It was something that was in the family. And I looked at it one day and I suddenly realized what it was. It was a prayer bell from some kind of a Hindu temple or something with a Hindu god on the actual handle. So the first thing I did, I got my hacksaw out and chopped the god off, got rid of him, that one smartly. And I think it's gone the way of all Hindu bells at the moment, or all the way Hindu bells will go. But you know, we shouldn't have that kind of stuff. What about love spoons? In here in Wales, we've got these love spoons that are carved. Where do they come from? They're fertility rites. I don't know whether it's a magic spoon that they put their elixir in, shove it down somebody's throat, and have lots of children or something. I don't know. But corn dollies. Do we allow those within our home? We should not do so. Corn dollies are coming now. I'm really saying things about English culture. But corn dollies are fertility symbols. And you find them, go into the store and you find them. Or you get harvest festivals in our churches are full of them. Full of the things. And yet they are part and parcel of the same kind of idolatry. And we have these physical idols that we can accept. Again, African masks. How do they use these African masks? Now, I have two African carvings at home, which I really appreciate. They were given by the church. They're of a farmer and his wife. No problem at all. There's nothing religious about them. But some of these African masks are. And that's not, I wouldn't have them in the house. I don't want them in the house. If we. The question that we need to ask in all these cases is, I mean, if Jesus Christ was here, would he have it? If Jesus Christ was you or me, would he in fact have whatever it is that is there? Now, I'm chopping out scriptures as I go along, so I don't see. I think I'm all right. Let's have a look at another one that's there. Yes, turn over to Judges 2, Judges chapter 2. I think we need to put this one in. I should know by now how many scriptures to have, but there's always a temptation to stick another one in. But here in Judges chapter 2, it says, "The angel of the Eternal came up from Gilgal," in verse 1, "to Bochim and said, 'I made you to go up out of Egypt, and I've brought you into the land which I swore to your fathers, and I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And you will make no league with the inhabitants of this land. You will throw down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice.' Why have you done this?" Why have we done this? Why have we got a land the way it is today? But notice what it says in verse 7. It says, "And the people served the Eternal all the days of Joshua, all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen the great works of the Eternal that he did for Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Eternal, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the Mount of Ephraim, on the north side of the hill Gaash. And also all that generation were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation." And this was the problem. And today's society, we've got to be very careful. And you young people that are listening to me need to be aware of this. That, okay, you haven't necessarily been personally taught by Mr. Herbert Armstrong, as my wife and I were in college. But you can go back and you can read the things that went on. You can go back and see what the foundation was that was laid. And we can, in fact, hold fast to what was laid by Jesus Christ within the church. "And there arose another generation after them which did not know the Eternal, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Eternal and served Baal," or Balaam. "And they forsook the Eternal God of their fathers, which brought them up out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods, of the gods of the people that were round about them. And they bowed themselves to them and provoked the Eternal to anger, and they forsook the Eternal, and they served Baal and Ashtoreth." And what do we have today? We have Mithras and Astarte, Christmas and Easter, the two main festivals, and they're tied into this very thing. These two specific, Baal, the Lord, that we again see within, banded around continually within so-called Christianity, the Lord, Baal, and Ashtoreth, Easter, the very things that we look at and we see within society today, where there is any kind of religion whatsoever. When we're looking at food offered to idols, and we go into the area of food offered to idols, we see, without turning to it, we can see over in Daniel how Daniel did not eat the king's food. And it was very much a case that he didn't eat it because it was presumably offered to idols. It was looked upon as common. It would be classed as common. In other words, it was not something fit to eat because it had been offered to an idol. And if we look in again, don't turn there, but Acts 10, where Peter had the vision, he was on the rooftop and the sheet came down, all these unclean animals were in the, it wasn't just unclean animals, it was animals that were in there. And he said, I've never eaten anything that has been common or unclean. The word unclean is unclean that we understand, pigs and horses and rabbits and that kind of thing. But when we look at common, then it is non-kosher. It is, perhaps it's been offered to an idol. Perhaps it's been, you know, who knows where it's come from. And these things, when you look in Acts 15, then you can go, you progress through that. But let's turn over to Acts 15, we might as well. We find here in verse 19, it says, therefore my sentence is, this is coming from James, that we do not trouble those that are from the among the Gentiles that are turned to God, but we write to them that they abstain from pollution of idols. So specifically, this was pointed out to the Gentiles who lived in an idolatrous society, from fornication and from things strangled and from blood. For Moses of old time has in every city those that preach him, being read in the synagogues every Sabbath day. So they would get in the synagogues on the Sabbath day, because remember, they didn't have books as we do. They would hear the law of Moses, they would understand where other areas where they needed to change, but these areas were specific ones, they were specific problems at that time. Now if we turn over to 1 Corinthians 10, we can see this specific problem, and we can see how it progressed into a major problem within the church, because how do you get food that is not common? It's not case of unclean. You can tell whether something is a pig or a sheep, particularly if it's kind of hanging there in the butcher's shop, which it probably would be. They wouldn't go ahead and cut the meat and leave it out on the slab. They would leave it hanging there because it would presumably go bad in a far less space of time, rather than it's like you try putting mince outside as opposed to a great slab of meat. It's not going to go bad in quite the same space of time as the mince would. So they could see whether in fact something was unclean. But here in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, there was another problem, and that was they couldn't see whether something had been offered to an idol or not. And therefore there was vegetarianism basically within the church, because they literally could not trust the meat. It was common meat. It was sold in the marketplace and therefore was common. In chapter 10 verse 1 it says, moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and they were baptized to Moses. So he points people back to the Old Testament, back to the Israel of old. And down in verse 6 it says, now these things, all the various things that happened to them, were our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Neither be idolaters, as were some of them. As it's written, the people sat down to eat and drink, and then rose to play. The eat and drink was part and parcel of the idolatrous practices that they were engaged in, and then played sexually, which was also part of that problem there. Neither let's commit fornication, as some of them also committed, and that was referring back to this rising up to play. And fell in one day 23,000. And he goes down in verse 11. It says, now all these things happened to them for examples. They are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the age are come. Therefore, let him that thinks he stands, you take heed lest he fall. And every one of us needs to listen to this and say, well, okay, am I out of step? Am I off track in this particular area? Is my attitude correct in this area? Because here it says, there's no trial taken you that such is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tried above that which you're able, but will with the temptation also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. It's talking in the context of food offered to idols. It's talking in this context. We see, therefore, he says, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. There's the benchmark. It's not just a case of accepting this multiculturalism. You know, get away from it. Flee from idolatry. We must not have a God different from the true God. I speak to you as wise men, judge what I say. And it goes into a contrast between the Passover and the practices of the Gentiles around them. And it said in verse 19, it says, what shall I say then? That the idol is anything, or that which is offered in sacrifice to idol is anything. But I say the things that the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons. So when we are looking at these, many of these things, certainly these New Age practices, I mean, there was we saw a program the other night about some kind of settlers in America. They were trying to go back to the kind of the way the settlers first started in America, and they had these New Agers in there, and they were skinny dipping in the local creek and not attending the church on the Sabbath, which was Sunday, of course. And so they were trying at one stage to put back into place what in fact had been under the pioneers of old, and yet they had this multiculturalism mixed up with it. And it says, the things the Gentiles sacrifice to, they sacrifice to devils. Let's not make any bones about this. And not to God. And I would not that you should have fellowship with devils, with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You can't be partakers of the Lord's table and the table of devils or demons. Do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than him? All things I am from. I won't go into that in a great deal, but you can translate this probably better. All things I am from, but all things are not expedient. In other words, I can approach things in all kinds of different ways, but it doesn't give the right result. All things I am from, but all things do not edify or profit me. So in other words, it's a way, how do I approach this subject? How do I get to God's mind in this subject? This is what Paul's saying. How do I approach this subject in the way God would approach it? Because here we've got people in the church who are having problems getting meat to eat. Let no man seek his own, but every another man's welfare. Whatever is, and here's the solution that he gives to the church, as he says, there's no trial, but God will give you a solution. Here is the apostle giving the solution. Whatever is sold in the shambles, eat, asking no question for conscience sake. This is how you get around it. This is how you're able to have meat, and yet, even though the society is steeped in idolatry. For the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. If any of them that believe not bid you to a feast, and you are disposed to go, whatever is set before you, eat. And he's not talking about unclean food. He's talking about food offered to idols here. Asking no question for conscience sake. But if any man say to you, this is offered in sacrifice to an idol, then you don't eat. Now, how does that apply to us? Remember, it says flee idolatry over in verse 14. How does it apply to us? Well, what about Christmas cake? Somebody around Christmas time gives you a piece of cake. Eat, asking no questions for conscience sake. But if somebody around Christmas time offers you a piece of cake and says, will you have a piece of Christmas cake? Don't eat for conscience sake. This is the application. Same with things like birthday cake. I know that Stollen is something which I really like. I don't know whether you've ever come across Stollen, but Stollen is the Dutch Christmas cake, and it's got a marzipan centre, and there's cakes on the outside, and it's very, very pleasant. But you've got to be careful with that, because it is a Christmas cake. Christmas pudding. Nothing wrong with making a plum pudding from a Christmas pudding recipe. But is it right to buy Christmas puddings with all the holly and mistletoe and everything else all on the outside? Is that really what we should be doing? Doesn't it say to us, it's saying, if any man says to you, this is offered in sacrifice to an idol, do not eat it. We've got to flee these things. We've got to put ourselves back on track in these areas. For his sake that showed it, and also for conscience sake. For the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. But conscience, I say, not only your own, is probably best translated, but of the others as well. For why is my liberty judged of another man's conscience? In other words, why should I go ahead and try and destroy somebody? But here we see the application. The food offered to idols is a problem today also. And we need to be aware. You know, there's no problem with having a meal with somebody. On Christmas Day, if necessary, if you'll sit down and have a meal. But if it's going to be a Christmas dinner, no, it's not. It's not. And this verse, these are the verses that you apply. This is how you understand these things. Going on to the next point, idolatrous containers. Let's turn over to 2 Kings. 2 Kings. Because it's not just the idol worship itself. It's like this meat offered to idols. That's not exactly an idol, it's just the meat. But over here in 2 Kings 23, here we see the King Josiah, and he found out about, in chapter 22, we see how, in fact, Josiah put the temple back together again and started to try and serve God, and he did the best as he could in his own human way. He was serving God and he was commended for it. But here in 2 Kings 23, notice in verse 3, and the king stood by a pillar, and he made a covenant before the Eternal to walk after the Eternal, to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all their heart and with all their soul, to perform the words of this covenant that were written in the book of the law. This is presumably be Deuteronomy. And all the people stood to the covenant. And the king commanded Hilkiah the high priest, and the priests of the second order, and the keepers of the door, to bring forth out of the temple of the Eternal all the vessels that were made for Baal. Notice, it wasn't just a case of getting rid of the idols. It was the very containers themselves had to be cleared out of the temple because they'd been used, they'd been polluted. These things might have even been used in the service of God in the past, but they were used to Baal. It had been made for Baal and for the grove and for all the host of heaven. So it looks like they were actually made for Baal. And for all the host of heaven. And he burned them outside Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron. That's the valley just south of Jerusalem, down the Kidron Valley. And carried the ashes of them to Bethel, and that's up in the north. And he put down the idolatrous priest that the king of Judah ordained to burn incense. But notice, it was in verse 4, it was the vessels as well that had been used and been made to Baal were part and parcel of the idol worship. They were idolatrous containers. Turn over to Deuteronomy 7, where we were before. This is where these concepts come from. We read about multiculturalism in the first few verses of Deuteronomy 7. If we look at the end of Deuteronomy 7, notice in verse 25, it says, the graven images of their gods you will burn with fire. You will not desire, notice, the silver or the gold that is on them, nor take it to you, lest you be snared therein, for it's an abomination to the Eternal your God. So even the very gold that's on there was not to be used. It wasn't to be taken to them. It's not just the idol. It's the actual making use of it. It's like the bell that we had. I chopped off the idol off the handle. That's not really good enough because the bell has been made. It's almost like you're trying to use it for another. It says for another use, and it says here, it says, nor take it to you, lest you're snared thereof. Again, the approach is something of getting rid of it. It's an abomination. It says in verse 26, it says, neither shall you bring an abomination into your house, lest you be a cursed thing like it, but you will utterly detest it. The attitude of mind, who is saying this? Jesus Christ is saying this. He's saying it to the church in the wilderness, God's people in the wilderness, and he's saying it to us today. And you shall utterly abhor it, for it is a cursed thing. We do need to be aware of this. And within our society that leans in this multicultural direction, we don't do this. We don't have this idea still. If we go over to Joshua chapter 7, I won't read a great deal of this, but here in Joshua 7, verse 1, it says, "The children of Israel committed a trespass in the accursed thing for Achan, the son of Carmi." Now this was, it wasn't an idol. This particular incident wasn't an idol. Notice in verse 5. "The men of Ai smote them, about 36 men. They chased them before the gate into Shebarim, smote them in going down there. The hearts of the people melted, and they became as water. And Joshua tore his clothes, fell on the earth, his face before the ark of the Eternal at eventide, and the elders of Israel, and they put dust on their heads." They were absolutely devastated by the fact that God did not grant them the easy victory that they expected. And you come down to verse 10, and the Eternal, now Jesus Christ now here, Jesus Christ said to Joshua, "Get up. What are you doing lying on your face? Get off your face. Get up. Stand up like a man. Israel has sinned. They've also transgressed my covenant that I commanded them. They've taken of the accursed thing, and they've even stolen and dissembled also, and they've put it in amongst their own stuff." So there are several things that actually happened here. There was a steal, something that had been stolen. Presumably a certain amount of booty was permitted. Some things had been stolen, but there was an accursed thing there as well. And it was that which was specifically mentioned over in verse 1. The trespass was really the accursed thing. It was taking something that was presumably gold that had been coming off an idol, or perhaps in a place that where idols were made. And verse 16, Joshua rose up early in the morning. They took their tribes and they whittled it down, and finally by lots they whittled it down until they finally got to Achan. And verse 20, "Achan answered Joshua and said, 'Indeed I have sinned against the Eternal God of Israel, and this I've done, that when I saw among the spoils a goodly Babylonish garment, 200 shekels of silver, a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight, I coveted them and took them, and they're in the earth in the midst of the tent.'" But here we see an approach. And remember, where is this approach being addressed by? It's by Jesus Christ himself, the head of the true church of God, that is going to return and establish a kingdom on this earth, who will sort out the rebels of Israel in the desert, in the wilderness, and will only allow a certain amount in. And believe you me, he is sorting out and sifting out the church today. There is a separation taking place, and we have got to get back on track in this area as well, in our attitude. Now, you know, what kind of things are we talking about? Idolatrous containers. Well, the one thing that springs to my mind, personally, if we had known, if we had really known and really understood this principle, if we had really kept it in mind, would we have tolerated the hymns that were brought in? Would we have done that? Can you take something dedicated to Baal, to Ashtoreth, and bring them into the Church of the Living God? Can you possibly do that? But that's exactly, and going backwards, if you listen to what Mr. Armstrong has said about that, you listen to the tape about what is sin. Just the first few minutes on what is sin, and he actually talks about his brother's music, and what in fact he was trying to do. Read the beginning of the hymnal, and the entire direction was to back to the Psalms. It was trying to bring God's words into the church. That was the direction, that was the way. I know there were certain hymns that are allowed in that purple hymnal, but the direction was very clear. And he said in that tape, if you go back and listen to it, that there's as many songs, again, many hymns as his brother composed, that we would be singing Psalms as we already are singing. So his direction was going in that way, was not to go back to Protestant hymns at all. And yet we swallowed it. Why? Because we forgot this basic principle. Idolatrous containers are also part and parcel of idol worship. And we have got to understand these things. This spirit of the law, and understanding the spirit of the law, we find over in Ephesians, if we go into the next point, in Ephesians chapter 5, it really is covetousness. If you turn over to Ephesians chapter 5, we find here in Ephesians 5, It says in verse 5, it says, "For this you know, that no whoremonger, or unclean person, nor covetous man who is an idolater," notice, "has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God." So if we are an idolater, we don't have an inheritance. That's what it's saying. And it is not just an idolater physically, that we get a physical idol and we bow down to a physical idol. It is spiritual as well. It involves covetousness. And this is why I say, you look in today's society, and we've read it that over in Isaiah 2, and it was clearly the end time fulfillment. And it's talking about there's no end to their chariots, and they worship their idols, the works of men's hands. And it is in today's society, it is in today's church, that those words are being directed. No whoremonger, nor unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. And let no man deceive you with vain words, because of these things comes the wrath of God on the children of disobedience. Do not therefore be like them, and be partakers with them. For you were sometimes in darkness, but now you are in light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. Getting back of track does sting. Every one of us can look at this subject of idolatry. You might think, you know, when I first started, that, okay, it doesn't apply to me. It does. It applies to every last one of us. We live in today's society. Laodicea comes out of today's society. We have this society all around us, and we've got to make sure we are reflecting a different society, a different way, a different mindset, lifestyle, culture. Now, it doesn't mean to say we go back to Victorian England. That's not the culture. That was not good enough. It is a different culture altogether. But I'll say this, that in Victorian England, certain of the things that made England great, certain things that made America great, came from this book. And it's the same things that will make the kingdom of God great. But it'll be more than that. It will be the mind of God. It will be the actual attitude and frame of mind that'll be there. And in this area of covetousness, of idolatry, we do need to realize that this is the case. I mean, Satan knows that idolatry will actually defeat the kingdom of God. If he can get us to have an idolatrous relationship, concept within our mind, how can we possibly be part of the kingdom of God? We can't, because God is going to be the one, and he alone will be glorified. Remember, go back to Isaiah 2. You know, it's like, you know, you see the Christmas cake, and it was good for food, and it's desirous, and pleasing and pleasant to the eyes, and it's desirous to make one fat, you know. So you eat it, and bone, behold, yes, it does make one fat. But, you know, we do. We could go down that road and say, it doesn't make any difference. Quite easy. Who's going to see? Who's going to notice? It's like where we used to work. Come the days of unleavened bread, invariably there would be the most luscious gattos coming out from being bought by the people there, and they would come round and say, "Oh no, I'll stick to my Rye Vita, thanks very much," and then look at you kind of sideways on. But turn over to Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14. Because there's a scripture here in Luke chapter 14 that we all need to take to heart, because really, it's when we're looking at idolatry, one of the commandments is not just the commandment that says, you know, you shall not make a graven image. It also, covetousness is the last commandment. You shall not covet. So that, as it says, which is idolatry. There's also the first commandment, you shall have no other God before me. That also fits as well. So here in Luke chapter 14, this also applies, where it says in verse 25, it says, "And there went great multitudes with him." This is Luke 14:25. "And he turned and he said to them, that if any man come to me And hate not, or love less by comparison, hate not his father and his mother, his wife, his children, his brothers, sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. Now, what happened within Worldwide is that the word disciple was undermined. They tried to make it something that it doesn't mean. They tried to make it some kind of a religious mumbo-jumbo and tried to undermine the clear meaning. The word disciple is student. So if we put something else, put another God before the only God, we can't be the student. Why? Because that student is training for the world tomorrow to implement God's way, God's lifestyle, God's culture on the earth as a whole. And if we have a different lifestyle, a different culture, if our values are different, we can't be a student. It's not possible. So if any man come to me and doesn't love less his father and mother and wife, children, brethren, sisters, yes, and his own life as well, he can't be my student. And whoever doesn't bear his stake and come after me, he cannot be my disciple, my student. For which of you intending to build a tower doesn't sit down first and counts the cost, whether he's got sufficient to finish it? Lest after he's laid the foundation, he's not able to finish it, all that behold begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and he wasn't able to finish. Or what king going to make war against another doesn't sit down first and consults whether he was able with 10,000 to meet him that comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the others are great way off, he sends an ambassador and desires conditions of peace. And so likewise, whosoever it is of you that doesn't forsake all that he has, he cannot be my student. There is only one God, and that God demands that we love that God with heart, soul, and might. That's the first commandment. And there is there's no half measures whatsoever. When we look at Christ's temptation, we won't turn there, but if you go and read what it says regarding Christ's temptation, it says, make these stones bread. And he says, man should not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. By that shall a man live. And as it says here in this particular section over in Luke 14, it says, love less his father, mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. So his own life as well. It's the selfish side that God is dealing with. And so when we go into this point number 6 about the self as an idol today, I mean, we're told, if you put in your notes 2 Timothy 3:2, about men will be lovers of themselves. You know, the old joke, he's a self-made man and he worships his creator. And that is the way people are in many cases. And today it's a specific problem. It is going to be a specific problem. So here within the church, we need to ask ourselves, have we made ourselves an idol? Because it says here very plainly, we cannot be that student if we have. We cannot be the student of God if we have. And that expands. It's my wife, my family, my job. Have we made the job an idol? My team, my prestige. What about my church? And we therefore castigate other people because they're not here specifically. Again, I know why I am here and I'm not somewhere else. But God is working with people, and he'll work with them in his way and in his time. And it's not for me to go ahead and start and then using the human solution, which is my church. If we turn over to Job 27, we see within Job, here is somebody who was righteous. There's no question about that at all. But how come righteous? What kind of righteousness? It says in verse 1 of Job 27, it says, moreover, Job continued his parable. And the word parable, by the way, isn't parable as we have it in English or even in the Greek. The word here it means something that, it's almost like a statement that comes down from an authority. That's what it's actually saying. However, Job continued his parable and said, "As God lives, who has taken away my judgment, who's taken away my judgment, and the Almighty, who has vexed my soul." Where's his center? His center wasn't on God. "All the while my breath is in me, and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, my lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit." It was all Job-centered. He was self-righteous. In other words, it is the focus that was on Job all the time. He was righteous for his reasons. He couldn't become, he couldn't be a student of Christ under that attitude of mind, that frame of mind. "God forbid that I should justify you till I die. I will not remove my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast. I will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live." Absolutely adamant that he hadn't done anything wrong. But he didn't realize that he was human. He was dirt. And God is God. His focus was totally wrong. Self-righteousness is not to do with the degree of righteousness. Self-righteousness is, where is your focus? If you're righteous because of yourself, you can be as righteous as you like. What good is it? If you're righteous to place yourself under God, and your focus is on God, and it is God's righteousness in us, that's a different matter. Over in chapter 29, notice verse 2, it says, "Oh, that I was in months past as in the years when God preserved me." And he goes on in verse 11, he says, "When the ear heard me, then it blessed me, and when the eye saw me, it gave witness to me." Notice the me's, the I's, me, myself, and I throughout this little passage. It says, "Because I delivered the poor that cried to the fatherless, and him that had done that had none to help him. The blessing of him that was ready to perish came upon me. I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy." He did all these righteous things. But notice why. "I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My judgment was a robe and a diadem. I was the eyes to the blind. The feet was and feet was I to the lame. I was the father to the poor, and the cause which I knew are not, I searched out, and I broke the jaws of the wicked, and I plucked the spoil out of his teeth. And then I said, I shall die in my nest, and I shall multiply my days as the sand. My root was not..." And on it goes, and it's me, myself, and I continually. The only reason for the righteousness was for Job. That's what it's all about. "And if any man love not less his life, also he won't be there." He cannot be a student. If you want to compare that, you can compare what we're reading here in Job with what it says over in Isaiah 14. You don't have to put, don't turn there. But you look at the attitude of Satan in verse 13 to 14. "I will ascend above the mount of the Most High. I will set my..." And it's the same kind of thing. The attitude that you see here in Job was a satanic attitude. Albeit doing righteous things. But it's still a satanic attitude. It was Job-centered. And it was the idol was himself. Sometimes it was necessary that we have thorns in the flesh. Paul had to have a thorn in the flesh to make sure that he had the right approach. Now that doesn't happen to many at all, but sometimes it might. Okay, final point. What about the Sabbath? You see, the thing about the Sabbath, it is linked to our idolatry. And we find quite clearly over in Revelation 13 how the mark of the beast is going to be imposed. It will be imposed at the end time. And that mark of the beast is to do with the Sabbath, or the keeping of Sunday. It's the keeping of pagan days. It's the imposition of these pagan days. And it's going to be that the Laodicean church is going to have to stand on its feet and stand up and be counted in the areas that really do count, putting God first in order to demonstrate that they do indeed put God first. I say they, maybe us. We can't say we're going to be guaranteed. We've got to be back on track. We've got to be walking in the way that God says. Come what may. Doesn't matter whether we're in a safer place of safety or we're not. That is the way we're going to go. Come what may. That is the approach that we must have. Because he who seeks to save his life is going to lose it. He who loses his life for my sake, for the same will find it, will save it. But turn over to Deuteronomy 5, Deuteronomy chapter 5. We find here in Deuteronomy chapter 5, in verse 12, notice it says, "Keep the Sabbath day to sanctify it as the Eternal your God has commanded you." So there's the command from God. 6 days your labor, do your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Eternal your God. In it you will do no work therein. Neither you nor your son nor daughter nor manservant nor maidservant, your ox nor your ass or any of your cattle or stranger that's within your gate, that your manservant and your maidservant may rest as well as you. In other words, it's going to be a blessing going out, and we certainly see this if you want to write in your notes Exodus 23:12, where it talks about all around us being refreshed. It talks about people around us and talks about them also being refreshed as well. So that's part of the Sabbath command. And he says, "And remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and that the Eternal your God brought you out from there through a mighty hand, by a stretched out arm. Therefore the Eternal your God commands you to keep the Sabbath day." We're no longer a slave. We're no longer serving idols, even if that idol is ourself. The one who we serve now is God himself. And we show that through our keeping of the Sabbath. Now why should that be the case? Because it tends to rein in the tendency to put something before the true God. It helps us to come to services, or to listen to services, to get our minds focused once again and get our minds turned back to God again. It keeps us in the ways of God. That's what the Sabbath's for. One of the vital reasons of the Sabbath. This is why it says in Leviticus 23, again, put it in your notes, verses, I think it's about 1 to 3, that the Sabbath is a holy convocation, it's a gathering. And this is why it says in Hebrews 10:25 that we shouldn't be forsaking such gathering, such assembling together. And it says so much the more as you see the day approaching. This is why we go to Fowlfield, that's Hebrews 10:25. This is why we go to Fowlfield. We've got to put all the scriptures in place in regard to the Sabbath. It's not just, right, we've got to rest. No, we've got to rest, yes. We've also got to assemble. We've got to have a convocation. We've also, as it, again, put it in your notes, Isaiah 58, verse 13 to 14, we've got to make it a delight as well. It's a delight. It's got to be made a delight. All of these scriptures come into play, and it points us back to the Creator. It makes us contemplate, you know, the fact that God made all things and actually implemented the Sabbath day as well as the final piece of his creation. That was the one that was Jesus Christ. And it also points us forward to the millennial rule. Again, the focus is where? It's on God. And therefore the idolatry side is countered by the Sabbath. So that's why the two go hand in glove. That's why when you're looking at the scriptures that talk about the reason why people go into captivity, the Sabbath breaking and idolatry are put together. Almost invariably you'll find the two being placed together. It's all part and parcel of the command. It's a means of delighting in the ways of God, delighting in the teachings of God, refreshing, getting our minds focused once again on what is important, reining in our jobs, which implement, you know, impact on our lives so much, reining in all the things, all the my's, you know, my wife, my family, my job, my team, my Game Boy, my computer, my broadband, whatever it may be. Get our mind off it and get our minds onto the things that count. Micah chapter 4. Micah chapter 4. This final scripture. Verse 1. "But in the last days it will come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Eternal will be established in the top of the mountains, will be exalted above the hills, and the people shall flow unto it. And many nations shall come and say, Come and let us go up to the mountain of the Eternal, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law will go forth out of Zion, the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem." So we're looking in the future. This is not something that's already happened. This is yet to happen. And he shall judge among many peoples and rebuke strong nations afar off. They'll beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. This is what the focal point of the Sabbath is, that we're looking to the time when this kingdom will actually be on earth. But they shall sit, every man, under his vine and under his fig tree. None will make them afraid, for the mouth of the Eternal of hosts has spoken. For all people may walk, every one, in the name of his God. Whatever idol you've got, whatever idol the world has got, whatever idol the world puts into place, oh, they can go and they walk in the name of their God. But we will walk in the name of the Eternal, our God, for eternity. That's the difference. That's what we're aiming for. You see, the God, the one true God, is the one who has the focus, who must have the focus in our lives. We're learning that. We're learning that, ready to be teachers in the future of that lifestyle. And we're looking for that time. And all the people that we see around us, they can walk every one in the name of his God. All the idols, all the idolatry, all the various icons and everything else. But we have got to get ourselves back on track in this area. Because if we do, then we can indeed, as it says here, walk in the name of the Eternal, our God, for eternity.